Hello, and thanks for listening to the inaugural episode of Sactown Talks by the Nooner with Scott Lay, and of course, I'm Jabran Masial. We're excited to rebrand and bring you the most relevant and timely talks in California politics and policy today. We threw out the script and decided instead to just have a conversation. Thank you to our first guest, Assemblymember Brian Mainshine, and his staff for coming on the show. Interested in becoming a sponsor or a guest of the show? Send either one of us an email, scottlay@gmail.com or jabran@sactowntalks.com. Our contact information is also provided in the show notes below. Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoy the talk.
I mean, literally, this is what we do on Twitter while we're listening for 45 minutes.
It looks blue to me.
Yeah, I think that looks blue.
I think it does.
Like gray blue?
Next
yeah.
Year's.
That looks
yeah.
Blue to me. All right, here we go. In 3, 2, 1, welcome back. It's the inaugural episode of Sactown Talks by the Nooner. I'm your host, Jabran Masial.
I'm Scott Lay.
He's your host, Scott Lay. We are pleased to be joined today by Assemblymember Brian Mainshine.
I have a hard enough time spelling it.
Yeah, you know? The spelling it is harder. The saying it is a little easier, at least, than the spelling.
Mainshine.
Yeah. You got it.
Yeah, just a little bit of nervous energy going on there. So for folks listening, we've built up a little bit of an audience over time. Sactown Talks has always been like a, you know, talks with Sacramento's movers, shakers, and eclectic personalities. Scott Lay is one of my favorite of those personalities, but he's also decidedly in the political world, and that's always been a vision for at least probably about a third of the episodes to be political and to have an ongoing discussion of California politics and policy. So I'm pleased to be teaming up with Scott Lay of the Nooner. It's going to help us get into more households. It's going to help us captivate the sort of capital community audience. And frankly, he brings... if they gave out belts in California politics, he'd be a black belt. He's got 20 years of political experience. And just if you read his newsletter, The Nooner, I think probably an unmatched mind analytically. Mr. Mainshine, you just switched your registration from Republican to Democrat for a number of reasons. Why don't you just kind of introduce yourselves?
Sure.
You know, there'll be a number of political folks listening to this, and also a number of folks who are just kind of listening. So, from that perspective, maybe just kind of.
Sure. Yeah. It was it was something that was probably a long time in coming. I just where my values were lined up with was as increasingly over time, I was finding myself that I was voting so often with the Democratic Party. I was finding my allies were with the Democratic Party. I was, and I wasn't always, well received within the Republican caucus sometime on some of those votes. And so when I was really evaluating it and looking at the issues that I cared about, the things that I felt, I was really more in line with the Democratic Party. Of course, you throw Trump in and you throw the kind of the continuing movement rightward of the Republican Party at a time where, I was probably moving a little bit to the left too. It really just felt like, the right thing to do. I'm really happy that I did it.
Yeah.
How's the reception been?
It's been really good. I mean, I certainly what I would sort of classify as the professional Republican class a little bit that, they've been, obviously a little, maybe, I don't know that necessarily surprised. I mean, I think the reaction generally was like, we always thought he was a Democrat anyway, is kind of what I generally sums it up.
He was a rhino.
Yeah, all that stuff. So that part of it was there. And, the reception on the Democratic side has been really good. I mean, they've been really nice to me, people I've worked with for a long time. The speaker has been great. All the my colleagues in the assembly and over on the Senate side have been really good too. So
isn't that something that we see outside of the building, this perception that it's binary,
yeah,
that it's only Republicans and Democrats, everything's hyperpartisan. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes that crosses over parties, and people reflect their districts at the end of the day.
You're so right, Scott. I mean, that's why I always look at the job is, I'm here to represent my district. But you're right, too, is on the kind of secondary point, which is all these issues that come up, some of them small, some of them large, there's these working relationships that begin to sort of emerge. And you may find yourself working with somebody who geographically is far away from you, or maybe politically is farther away from you. And you develop these bonds and these relationships, and they, over time, they kind of grow. And you end up having these allies that somebody on the outside might see as surprising, but for people who are working together on these issues over time, see it as not that surprising.
Well, this will be released a few days after we record this, but today was the State of the State, and I think we saw that with Governor Newsom in talking about housing. And if you know about the issue of trying to encourage local governments to be more flexible into density and transit-oriented housing, if you know that issue, you know that one of the most NIMBY, not in my backyard, areas in the state is Marin County, where Gavin's permanent home is. Yeah. So I think that's where we saw, you know, an issue that transcends party and goes into regions. And Gavin, Governor Newsom, acknowledged that from the podium this morning.
Yeah, he took it on. You know, he took it on. And again, I think that's a great example, too, of something that really doesn't fall in terms of on a partisan basis, right? It may be geographic. It may be these sort of sub-issues, CEQA reform or inclusionary housing, these other issues that come into play that really aren't partisan.
Let's talk about your district. It's an interesting district for those that aren't familiar with it. It's north of San Diego, so it's within the city of mostly within the city of San Diego, if I believe.
Yeah.
But it's to the north, not coastal, a little bit inland. It's a district that voted for Mitt Romney in 2012 for Neel Kashkari for governor in 2014, and then gave essentially Hillary Clinton a landslide in 2016. Mm-hmm. Has the district itself changed much, or is it more the district aligning with the personalities on the ballot?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, essentially the district is a third, a third, a third, is really kind of where it comes down. And it's a district that votes, you know, Democrats will vote for Republicans and Republicans will vote for Democrats. There's some crossover voting. I think in the situation of Trump there was a partisan point to it, but I think overall it was just the way he carries himself, his personality, that I think there's a lot of people in my district who were sort of, even before his policies came into play, were kind of offended by the way he conducted himself. And I think that really led to Hillary Clinton having the result that she had.
I think for you, as a father of two young girls, right? His conduct towards women, his allegations of sexual assault. At some point, I'd be like, wow, this is the party of Trump. It can't be the party of me, right? Like,
and that's true. You know, to go what we were talking about earlier about switching parties, you know, I would look at some of the conversations. I'm a single dad to two girls. We'd have these conversations over dinner where they'd kind of hear these things that he had said. And again, more and more, it was, you know, it's pretty indefensible. I mean, what do you really say? You know, it's one thing for people to make mistakes and, you know, somebody says something wrong or whatever. You shouldn't bury them for that. But his conduct has been so over the top for so long that, yeah, I mean, it really was. You know, I'm trying to raise them and, and
how old are they? If you don't mind?
They're now 14 and 16.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So they hear, they know, they understand the consequences. Yeah.
And it's right as they're kind of forming these opinions, right? They're young adults. Mm-hmm. They're trying to piece this together. Yeah. They have parts of it. They don't have all of it yet. And so.
And that, at that age, like so many issues like self-esteem and identity and self-worth are really coming due. Hey, can I ask you quickly, we talked about the reception, like kind of what your reception in the building was like. And I'm kind of wanted to touch on that and kind of maybe peer behind the curtain a little bit for folks who, kind of from an inside the building perspective, because I expect there'll be some, I hope there'll be some just regular folks listening, right? There's like this institutional class that works behind the Republican caucus and works behind the Democratic caucus. And there's just like all these cogs in the machinery that are working on both sides of the aisle, right? So you probably got a new, you know, DCO consultant. You're getting the Democratic floor alert now. You know, your committee chair, your committee assignments. I don't know if those have changed. I didn't do that research. What your list of you know, lobbyists who now have access to you because you're aligned with a new party. Not that they wouldn't have access to you otherwise, but just like all these little mechanical things kind of change, right? What's that been like?
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting. I will say it hasn't been as big a change. Some of those things you're talking, the staffing type changes, yes, definitely, yep. Because you sort of go from the Republican apparatus to the Democratic apparatus. At the end of the day, though, it's kind of the same idea, right? But just a different, an R or a D next to it. But the apparatus is relatively similar. And I would say in terms of the people that come in, you know, I really did have an open door policy. So somebody who, you know, crossed the party line so much, I've always had a good relationship with labor. I've always had a good relationship. So I really was seeing those groups as a Republican
too.
So that really hasn't changed that much, I wouldn't say.
And maybe this is more of a, you know, for yourself. I mean, I don't want to speak for anybody or kind of like bring them into this, but certainly, you know, staff is oftentimes like they're political operatives or, you know, as much, right? And so they've like, well, I've been a Republican staffer forever now. I can't work for a Democrat. Or, you know, I might need to find the door, right?
Yeah.
Is that the sort of thing where it's like, hey, you kind of sit down and say, hey, you know, if we need to part ways, or you're welcome to stay, or kind of what, you know, not to put anyone on the spot.
No, I'm really proud. My staff has stayed, you know, and we've had a great relationship, and it's so they've stayed because I think they share the goals that I have, and I'm happy about that. I'm glad they did. Yeah.
Now you would also be the first, I think, legislator that's changed parties that has a real strong hope of re-election. Mm-hmm. You're halfway through your 12 years in the assembly, but the last two I can think of off the top of my head that changed parties really in the 90s, early 2000s from the Central Valley, they lost re-election. Mm-hmm. But you're in a different category. And is that because it's San Diego? San Diego has this tradition, and it goes back a long time. It's not a new phenomenon of having a lot more malleability among the parties. You mentioned a third in partisanship. It is. It's 32% Democrat, 32% no party preference, 31% Republican. Right. You can't split it more closely than that. You know, I think back to Pete Wilson, who before the 1994 campaign took him to the right on immigration, coincidentally. He was a very San Diego Republican. Mm-hmm. Is this kind of part of the tradition of San Diego?
I think so. I think there is this tradition in San Diego that there's sort of these more moderate voices that they, you know, if you look at sort of who's come out of San Diego, you know, for the most part, pretty moderate type people. And even, you know, you look at my district, the congressman who's a Democrat, Scott Peters, is very moderate. Mm-hmm. You know, me, more moderate. You know, you have these kind of Tony Atkins, people who I think San Diegans like to see people trying to get things done. They value some independence. I think they like that. And there's not really, you know, a lot of extreme partisanship, I would say.
And that's interesting because the Democratic activists, as they do everywhere, mm-hmm. wanted to take you out. Mm-hmm. They wanted you to be priority number one to take out in last year's election. But the people I talked to around Sacramento felt, you know, you don't take out people that are reasonable people that are willing to work across the aisle, even if you might lose a race and not add on to your supermajority in the assembly. At the end of the day, you changed parties, but there really wasn't a lot of momentum to go after mm-hmm. you, even though, you know, I think some of the LGBT folks in San Diego that are holding on to that 78th Assembly District that's had Christine Kehoe, mm-hmm. Tony Atkins, and now Todd Gloria would have loved to have moved to the north and capture one more seat. But you didn't see that from Sacramento, and I think that's probably true of both the electeds and the institutions here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy about that because I do have great relationships with my colleagues. I'm proud of that. And so I agree. I think there really was, you know, the people knew that I had taken a lot of tough votes. They knew I was an independent sort of thinker and voice. They knew that they, even if I didn't always vote their way, they could at least come talk to me. You know, on SB2, the one that I really went out there on and took a tough vote on, I think there was this feeling that he's taken all these tough votes. You know, he's somebody we can work with and is reasonable, does a good job representing his district. So there really wasn't this momentum of, we've got to just take him out just because of the letter by his name. And you know, the reality in politics is you're going to have activists on both sides that just the only thing that matters is the letter behind the name. That's it. Mm-hmm. But I think where most people kind of find themselves is they do respect and look at the, they want to respect and vote for the person who holds that office, even if they don't always agree, or even if they're, they have to cross party lines to do it. I've always been happy that back when I was a Republican, I got Democratic support. I hope that as a Democrat, you know, I'll still have support from some Republicans and NPP. I think that's how you get things done, is that you don't just put yourself into one straight silo, that you try to work with people of both political parties and people who don't want to affiliate with a political party.
Can we stop here? And you just kind of like the, your chief is in your district office.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Lance.
Yeah.
Wonderful to work with, mm-hmm. by the way. On this.
Oh, thank you.
He's seen like what's coming into like, you know, brianmainshine.asm.gov. Uh-huh. Like, has there been any blowback from like the, like, are you guys getting any like nasty emails or, like, from the community? I mean, somebody, mathematically, there's got to be some
sure.
people who are disappointed,
I think,
right?
Of course. And, you know, anytime you have social media, right, you have, you also have trolls, right?
Hey,
you have,
that guy sucks.
You have somebody from Michigan, right? Yeah. We had somebody from Michigan sending an email, you know, very angry. You know, and so it's, I didn't know that this guy from Michigan probably was following much of my career beforehand, but apparently I guess he was highly disappointed in it. But, you know, so, yeah, of course you're, you know, it's an outside of the box thing to do. It's an unusual thing to do. Again, having said that, I think that, you know, there is a growing sense among a lot of people that the Republican Party has moved pretty far to the right. I think there's also an understanding that Donald Trump is divisive. I think there's a pretty good acceptance of that too. And so you kind of put those things together, and then somebody like me who really just was, I was never a partisan. I never was somebody who was, you know, rah-rah on the partisan. So
I don't think
it was surprising.
What was the analysis that the UT did with you and Tony?
Yeah, so Tony and I, when we were on the city council, it was something, they did an analysis, and we had voted together something like 93% of the time, or 90s. It was some 90-plus percent of the time, because I think we were two people who were trying to, you know, run a city and trying to get things done. And my guess is, frankly, even on the votes that we didn't vote for, they probably actually weren't partisan. They were probably something having to do with her wanting something for Hillcrest, or me wanting something for Scripps Ranch or Rancho Bernardo. So I think it probably, if I had to guess, that's where that fell too. So I think that with all of that, I don't think there was, and if you looked at a lot of the reaction, even from the right, was, you know, we always thought he was a Democrat anyway. You know, the issues that I kind of care about, you know, have tended to follow on that line. So I think that, yes, of course, you're going to get some people who, but it wasn't this, you know, huge pitchfork mob of people.
Do we also just notice it more among legislators, and that would include members of Congress, members of the House?
Yeah.
You know, we see in local government, they're nonpartisan.
Right.
So you have in San Jose, you have Johnny Camus, who's a city council member. He changed from Republican to Republican to no party preference last year, specifically on the Trump administration's treatment of migrants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's clear that Bill Clinton, after the 1994 drubbing, moved significantly toward the middle, or some would say toward the right of the middle, after the Gingrich Revolution. We don't take notice of that. Democrats are still there wearing the Bill Clinton pins. Nobody notices Johnny Camus' party change, except for me when I'm writing an analysis, because he's running for the 15th Senate district next year. But are you put under an unfair spotlight because you're not moving that far? It just kind of has to do with a letter after your name because you're in elective office, even though in your district, Republican registration has declined by 6.8%, mm-hmm. while no party preference has gone up by 7.2% over the last mm-hmm. 6 years.
I think legislators always, because they're legislators, it sort of falls into a labeling situation. But I agree with you. I think, again, you know, kind of on the city council levels and these other levels where they're trying to manage a city, they're trying to get the trash picked up, they're trying to make sure that someone picks up the phone when you call 911. Mm-hmm. They're getting potholes filled. Most of what they do is not partisan. It's running a city. And so, yeah, if somebody, you know, would quote move to the left or quote move to the right, it really wouldn't be noticed. It'd be kind of just that, well, yeah, I guess they did that to get this done, and they did that to get the other thing done. At the state and federal level, where it becomes shorthand for your views, I think sometimes it gets lumped into that, when the reality is, you know, to go back to somebody like me, I was really voting, you know, I was pro-choice. I was already voting, you know, you mentioned LGBT, you know, I was 90 to 100% on my scorecards from them anyway. That doesn't really come out because we've gotten in this shorthand of labels and what these labels mean. And generally speaking, they may be right, but they're not necessarily right in all the cases.
Do you think the Republican Party in San Diego is threatened as a brand? Is that part of the statewide trend, or is that underlying demographic changes in the greater San Diego region?
It's probably all of the above. I mean, I think the Republican Party has not done a good job, and I always said this, of reaching out, you know, expanding the tent, doing those things that the Democratic Party has always been great at. And it's shown, you know, they are not only is registration shrinking, they're just becoming less effective. And I think a lot of it is the brand, and it's the way they've kind of looked at things. Is you know they want this absolute purity and on a message that I think increasingly is moving to the right at a time when the population is either staying sort of in the it's kind of center left a little bit, and they're falling by, and they're falling behind because of it. I don't know if they don't seem to realize the problem or see that they need to modify their message. But there's been people in the party for a long time who've been saying they need to kind of change their message.
Yeah, I feel like the fire breathers don't do so well in San Diego. I mean, like Carl DeMaio can't win an election to save his life. You know, man, stay in radio, brother. Like that's going good for you, man. But he just can't win, right? Because he's a fire breather. No one wants that. Kevin Faulkner is doing the best. And again, he's Kevin Faulkner. He's not like Republican fire breather.
Jerry Sanders.
Same way.
Yeah. And to go back to what you said earlier about sort of the San Diego brand, it's not fire breathers. It's kind of these more moderate voices who are trying to get things done, not the people who are screaming and yelling from the sideline.
Well, I also heard in Sacramento from Democratic side and Democratic friendly lobbyists, et cetera, that there was a disappointment that Joel Anderson lost in the Board of Equalization race. And I don't know Mike Schaefer. I talked to him via email, and I don't opine on that race itself. But I saw that from Democrats are kind of like, you know what? He was a nice guy. And we lost a nice guy who was running for Board of Equalization. And say what you will about the future of Board of Equalization. And I don't think a lot of people sweated that race on either side all that much. But there was this kind of ownership of a loss of one of our own on both sides of the aisle from when losing Joel Anderson from the San Diego area folks.
I think there's people that have, when you talk about kind of the larger picture of what you're talking about up here in Sacramento, is there are people who I think collectively the Sacramento community view as these are people who are trying to get things done. They're trying to, they're, you know, good men or good women who are, you know, have the right values and sort of the right attitude about the job. And so I do think sometimes Democrats may be disappointed about a Republican losing, and Republicans may be disappointed about a Democrat losing, because those personal relationships come into play. And they may have been helped out on a tough bill or a tough situation in a committee hearing that the public doesn't see, but those lawmakers start forming that bond.
You know,
you go through some certain things together, and pretty soon you find yourself being pretty close to some of these people.
Hey, let's talk about the Republicans kind of eating their own a little bit, you know. I mean, it's thinking about like Roger Nilo. You know, hey, Roger Nilo, if you ever want to come on the show, you're invited. But, you know, he was the one guy to vote for the budget, and they, you know, he was done. And then Bichetti, I think, was his name too. You know, same thing happened to him. Mm-hmm. Were you there for Richard Mercero at all?
You know, oh, when he was working in the building?
Yeah. And so my understanding is, like, my understanding was like the Republican Assembly Caucus, like the policy staff, was kind of like seen as these, like, hey, you know, we've got this ideological purity. These are the recommendations; they shall not be deviated from. You're invited. I'm putting myself out there. You're invited to opine on this or decline to opine on it as much as you want. But I think there's always a sense that, like, hey, who's kind of running the show over there? Like, the staff is gone. It's like the Terminator's gone sentient. You know, like do you do you feel like you have that same obligation to maintain this monolith of ideological purity as a Democratic, or do you feel like there's more of a spectrum?
I think there's much more of a spectrum on the Democratic side, much more. I think I'm much more accepting in all ways of that. Having said that, I obviously didn't feel too constrained on the Republican side because I was always in disfavor from all those people. So, I think that, you know, they expect, I think there was an expectation sometimes from Republican staff that you would just vote that way.
Yeah.
But I cleared that up with them real quick how I was going to vote. But I was so out of disfavor by then, it probably didn't matter anyway. But I just think the way the Democrats conduct themselves is just sort we're going to be a bigger party. We want to bring more people in. We understand that this is a very diverse state and diverse in all senses of that word. And it shows. It shows.
It's weird because my first fall in Sacramento, I was transferred to Davis for undergrad, and I'd been involved with statewide student politics. So I'd been involved in 93, 94, brutal budget fight. But my first year up here was the year of the most, you know, the famous fight of Willie Brown trying to hold on, where you had an evenly split assembly. And to go from an evenly split assembly of essentially 40-40, 41-39, 40-39 all over the place, to 60-20,
right,
is truly remarkable. Now, California has changed, but it really hasn't changed that much. So we talk about, you know, the Democrats are kind of like looking at enlarging their tent. They also have the strategic reason. They understand, you know what? We have to protect our members that are more vulnerable. Right. We understand the diversity of the state. I don't see that in the Republican Party. And my friends who are Republican consultants really don't see that either.
Mm-hmm.
Am I on the kind of the right track?
I think
you're
on the right track. And I think you're also on the right track to say what you said earlier, which is, you know, to go from essentially 40-40 to 60-20 is about more than just changing registration. I mean, that's about a message that is not resonating. And you look again, look how many seats don't even have a Republican running in it. Not even a candidate running. I mean, it's a massive amount. So I think the message that they have continually tried to push, it doesn't work in California. But the incredible thing is it's like they want to double down on the same message.
You know what's funny though, is like I'm still a Democrat, but like barely, man. But like I should be eligible and in play for the Republican Party. Okay. Like I just a little bit about myself. I'm a Mexican immigrant brought over here in my mother's arms. Okay. But I didn't come here to be a victim. Mm-hmm. Okay. I didn't come here to play identity politics. I think affirmative action is in a weird way trying to fight racism by fueling racism. Like I'm just not there in a lot, you know, the increasing role that identity politics plays in the Democratic Party is more and more turning me off. You know, I'm a Democrat because I want LGBT people to do whatever they want to do. I'm a Democrat because I believe in, you know, helping the least among us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's it. You know, I should totally be in play for the Republicans to say, hey, you know, why don't you come in here? You know, you came over here for a better life. We're going to get out of your way. And we don't care what people do in the privacy of their homes and their bedrooms. And we believe that people, you know, you want to talk about government out of your life? How about government out of your womb? We're just not even going to, like, we're not even, right to choose, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I should be, like, persuadable. So theoretically, somewhere, I should be persuadable towards the Republican brand. But their positions on immigration, it's just all so toxic that I can't even, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I just want to get that off my chest.
You bring up
felt good, right?
Yeah, it felt good.
You bring up immigration, and you know, I don't write on federal politics except as it affects California, and the complete non-understanding of Washington toward how San Diego works on immigration was just astonished me last year, which was, okay, we don't like what's going on, we're just going to close the border.
Mm-hmm.
And that has huge economic impacts on both sides of the border because we are an international community between Tijuana, Baja, and San Diego, and people go to school on both sides of the border, they work on both sides of the border. Did that play in to your decision and your election and the conversations
there? You know, I was on the city council for 8 years. We had a great working relationship with Mexico. They were allied people to the border, whereas people shopping on both sides of the road, whereas people vacationing on both sides of the road, all those things are great things. There's something to celebrate. So I agree. I think there's a disconnect between what's really happening on the ground in a place like San Diego versus what Washington apparently thinks is happening on the ground there.
Another person that I mentioned that switched parties was John Economist in San Jose, and he went from Republican to no party preference. Now he's in a nonpartisan office, so that's kind of a moot point. Mm-hmm. Did you think about going to an independent man without a caucus,
no,
if you will?
No, I didn't. I felt, you know, when I was looking at where my votes were aligned, they were really aligning with the Democratic Party. They weren't really aligning with a sort of independent, unnamed party, if you will. And if I looked at, you know, who the people who were supportive of me and the things that I cared about, they were Democrats. So I didn't have that sort of struggle or decision making. For me, it was pretty simple.
It, very similar. I was thinking about this morning at the State of the State, Maria Shriver, Arnold Schwarzenegger's ex-wife. I'm not sure on that. But she was introduced as leading a statewide effort under Gavin Newsom's leadership. And that reminded me back to, we talked about, you know, how executives can shift. And clearly Arnold Schwarzenegger shifted from being, you know, riding in on a white horse against the car tax and one other, and the car tax that, if I remember correctly, under Gray Davis, it was Steve Peace from San Diego, another independent, was director of finance, and he pulled that trigger that helped lead to Gray Davis being recalled. The other issue was rolling blackouts and energy crisis. Oh my, we're kind of back to some of the same issues: immigration, energy crises, and gasoline and car taxes. Arnold sort of got to a point where he was a man with no party. Mm-hmm. He's still a Republican to this day, but he started coming in as very conservative, riding this recall horse and fighting to repeal the gas tax. And then he became the leader on environmental issues for the state. And the Republican Party kind of backed off with him. And now he's buddy-buddy with former Governor Gray Davis, who he recalled. And, you know, I see a little bit of San Diego in the Santa Monica guy, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
That's funny. Yeah.
Well, it's good to, I think it's a good thing to evolve. I think we should mature and get wiser as we get older. I mean, that's a positive. If that means you change your position on some things, that's not a bad thing. You know, we have experiences in our lives as we age. You know, the most significant thing that happened in my life was getting a divorce when I had two really young girls and being a single dad to them since they were 2 and 4. And did that change my perspective? Yeah, it did. And I'm proud of that. I wouldn't hide from that. In fact, just the opposite. I think it's made me a better person in a whole lot of ways. So I don't think this notion that we need to come out of the womb, or we need to, by the time we graduate from college, we need to have our views locked down. We have
That's
real
crazy.
Life experiences,
yeah.
right?
Crazy,
we,
yeah.
12
we,
years
we change.
Is a long time.
It's a long time.
You know, for Republican parents in California that send their kids to Berkeley, that are fortunate enough to get their kid into Berkeley and their kid comes back,
all tattooed
and tie-dyed. They're like, okay, 12 years is a
long time.
We've got a few years for them to evolve back.
Well, I mean, but,
that's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, if you came to Sacramento and didn't learn anything,
that
should be.
What does that say about you? What does that
soul,
say about you?
It?
You know, what does that say? You should be trying to learn. You should be trying to improve yourself. You should be listening to people with diverse views and evaluate. It doesn't mean you have to accept every one of them, but you should be open-minded to it. And it's sort of sad that sometimes I think in politics we think like, oh no, you should never change.
Yeah.
The world changes. You know, we weren't talking about cell phone. I mean, look at technology. What all the changes that have happened in that, the world has changed.
Yeah.
And so I think we should understand that. Like you're saying, politicians, executives, people change. It's easier to see it in politicians. You don't see it if your dentist changes, right?
Right.
You don't see that. But I think it's a great thing that people.
I'm reading
about.
A great book right now, Walter Isaacson's The Innovators, and it's about the people behind the creation of technology, from Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, Wozniak, all the way to like Mark Andreessen and the creation of Mosaic, the first web browsers. And I realized that my first year at Davis was, my first semester at Davis, I was working in a computer lab, and it was like the first time that the internet was even really available in 1994.
Yeah.
I mean, and look at where we are right now,
where,
you know, the entire computer lab that I oversaw
fits in there.
Fits in this phone.
Well, then they say the one that the technology that sent men to the moon is now in our phone.
Right. I mean, you know, how crazy is that? I've been actually thinking about that a lot lately. I don't know
why.
That's
insane.
It's really insane because, like, what that means is that they kind of figured that out with protractors.
Right.
And it's like, if they like miss, like, sorry,
dude,
we shot you.
Do you think those guys knew that? Like, do you think those guys knew that? That they were, do you think they told them that? Like, we're pretty sure our calculations are right.
Like, I mean, they must have done that with like a sextant and a protractor.
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, dude, if we miss this thing, you're going to.
Those guys were brave.
Yeah, that's crazy.
That's crazy.
That's really crazy.
Yeah.
You know, right now I'm reading The Gulag Archipelago. It was a recommendation of Jordan Peterson. And it's an interesting book. It kind of talks about like all the like the forced work camps in the Soviet Union, you know. And it's interesting as a thought exercise, like parameterizing the left, right? So we've seen like the right go alt-right and fascist right many times. And so we kind of all have like this like very easy bookend. It's like, okay, when we start making claims of racial superiority, when we start, you know, making misogynistic language, we can very easily parameterize the right. We've seen it go bad in the past. But for some reason, like we seem to have like a harder and harder time parameterizing the left, right? One, because there's these claims of like, well, these constant encroachments upon your civil liberties are done in the name of the people, and you can kind of justify a lot of things like that. And, you know, I mean, Stalin killed like way more people than Hitler ever did, you know? But you can still like rock a Che Guevara t-shirt or an iron sickle, you know, nowadays. One, it's just kind of darkly, absurdly funny, you know? But two, I kind of like read it because I'm interested in this idea of like parameterizing the left. And, you know, to relate that to you, Brian, I kind of always thought like, okay, well, you're in the middle of the Republican Party. Now you're probably in the middle of the Democratic Party, right? I mean, there's probably some activism in the Democratic Party going on where you're probably not super comfortable with, right? I mean, identity politics, you know, open borders. I mean, all this, some of this stuff is probably, you're probably just as uncomfortable some of the Democratic talking points as you are with some of the Republican talking points. Is that fair to say?
Well, I just think there's a wide range. I mean, it's, okay. It's hard to characterize all of, you know, kind of where you fall or whatever.
Well, just wait till you go to your first convention, right. Man. There's going to be some.
That's what I've been told.
In San Francisco, no less. Wait till you go to your first
convention. You're preparing me for it all along.
Hey, how'd you get started in politics? Like, what was the?
I didn't have this like burning desire to work in politics. I never worked for a political party or for a politician. I was a young lawyer. I was working on a volunteer basis as the executive director of a program called Youth Court, which is a juvenile diversion program.
Okay, cool.
Took first time juvenile offenders and instead of sending them through the system, we worked in partnerships with local schools, local law enforcement to turn these kids around. Had a phenomenal success rate, and to make a longer story short, we started getting some awards. The mayor of San Diego at the time said, "I'm very interested in your program. Could you come down and make a presentation?" So I was like, "Wow, you know, the mayor of San Diego and." Making a presentation to, they like my program, and my program is really good for these kids. And we went down, and I made the presentation. I didn't hear back, and about a week later, they said, "Can you send the forms you use?" I said, "Oh, sure." And then finally, I called, I think after a month, they said, "Yeah, we're not going to do anything with your program. You know, thanks for coming in." And about a week later, the mayor unveiled her brand new idea.
Oh, no.
called Youth Corps. So it kind of made me realize, like, there's this whole thing at city government.
Wait, who was
like,
the mayor at the time?
It was Susan Golding.
Okay.
And so I decided, you know what, I should get involved in city government. So just, I like want to hug that boy that ran because he was so naive. But I fortunate enough to get elected in 2000. Wow. and then reelected in 2004.
Did you win your first race?
I did.
Okay.
I did.
What was that? You knocked on a lot of doors.
I knocked on a lot of doors.
Yeah.
Knocked on a lot of doors.
Yeah. Did you have a serious opponent?
Yeah. Yeah, I had a very serious problem with someone who was, you know, pretty heavily favored. The owner of the Padres and the owner of the Chargers not only supported them, but actually went door to door.
Oh my God.
You know, I think the owner of the Padres helped, probably the owner of Chargers. Not
I was
going to
say, which was maybe it not a good year?
I don't know. It depends what their record was at the time. But yeah, she was very heavily, I had a lot of opponents, all of them. I think there were nine of us, so I'm sure all eight were favored ahead of me, but certainly there were a couple that would have been heavily favored. And I was fortunate enough to win. I grew up there and I had enough of my, you know, teachers and my little league coaches. You talk about kind of the uniqueness of San Diego, but that's always who supported me, got me elected.
Community. Yeah.
Community.
Hey, you just got out of the state of the state.
Yeah.
Thanks for making time today.
Yeah, of course.
Your thoughts?
I feel cooler being in your place. Like I feel like I'm hipper somehow.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thoughts on the state of the state?
I thought he did a good job.
Working with the new Newsom administration. I imagine that there's probably somewhere, you know, in various assembly and Senate offices, piles of bills that were vetoed by Brown. And they're going to be like the try-agains with Gap, you know.
For sure.
Do you have any thoughts on what he might be open to on working with him?
I think you're right. I think a lot of bills that got vetoed, they're just going to be like, let's try it one more time and see what happens.
Bring the helmets back, all that
stuff. All that stuff's going to come back. Yeah. And we'll see, you know. Obviously, it's a different tone, different governor, different kind of tone, style. You know, he's much different. You know, Jerry Brown had that persona of, you know, kind of this grumpy.
I missed the Latin.
Yeah, right. You never knew what he was going to quote.
Yeah.
He would kind of get off track sometimes. It was interesting. And, you know, Gavin's got his style too, but I thought he did a good job. I mean, he went right after the issues. I mean, he went talked about spot on kind of what's going on.
I thought it was a masterful job.
Yeah.
I jokingly said on Twitter that I don't want to come across as a Gavin Newsom fanboy, but I have to go take a cold shower right now. Because it was like, wow, that was really, you know, nice to hear.
Yeah.
You know, people thought that Gavin, and I've told him that, you know, they thought he was an empty suit with nice hair.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, he went to Santa Clara University. Yeah, he may have got a baseball scholarship. And, you know, Jerry had this, you know, educational pedigree and his people had an educational pedigrees. You know, how's Gavin going to fare? And we've watched him as in his budget presentation, in handling PG&E. I mean, I was at two different press conferences where he was fielding PG&E questions that I've heard professional energy lobbyists not be able to answer on the fly without notes, without staff whispering in his ear. So I think he's really surprised people. Is that your take as well?
Oh, I think he's really smart. He's kind of wonkish, and you can tell he's got a passion for the – I agree. His budget presentation, phenomenal. I mean, phenomenal. I thought today, too, he's very conversant. He had this kind of ease, like he doesn't – he's not afraid, not only from a political level is he not afraid to talk about these things, but you got the sense that he knew what he was talking about. Yeah. That had he been asked questions on any of those, he'd have been able to field them pretty easily. That was the sense that I took from him.
Yeah, he was citing legal precedents.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he doesn't have a law degree. I'm like, I didn't know about that case.
And, you know, I try to tell people with the podcast, he was like, just don't say anything stupid and you'll be all right.
That's a good rule of thumb, probably.
The presentation was, reporters really needed to go to the bathroom because he just kept going on. Oh, but he was going on and on, not in an oratorical sense, but in a Q&A
detailed
sense.
Yeah.
Hey, we're getting pretty close to an hour. Just a few more questions, if you don't mind. What are your personal priorities for your district, whether it's just local projects or stuff you want to see done before you leave? And then just sort of, you know, examining the lay of that shit. We've got wildfires, body cameras are coming back, a number of issues. Just your open thoughts on 1920 legislation.
Yeah, I mean, I have a passion on homelessness and mental health issues. I was the homeless commissioner for San Diego, which was really, speaking of, a life-changing experience too. Mm-hmm. And so those issues are I care a lot about, and we'll be doing some more on that. We've done a lot of bills on mental health and homelessness to date. I'll continue to. I care a lot about animals. And so I'll do a few more on that. I like that.
Jennifer Fearing.
As I said, that's a shout out to Jennifer Fearing.
Jennifer, come on the show.
So I will do some on that too. And, you know, and just to continue to represent my district, make sure we're doing our constituent service, which we take pride in. You know, I'm very active and visible in the community. We'll keep doing that too. So, and then just seeing, you know, it's going to be exciting with the new governor, seeing what that means. And then obviously at some point we'll probably inevitably have a downturn, hopefully not as bad as the days when you were there and talking about that. Mm-hmm. But I think we need to be thinking about that these good times can't last forever. And what are we doing to prepare for that?
Well, and what can we do during these good times and with the state, the general fund's wealth right now, the PPIC report was PPIC poll was interesting, where voters think that the California budget is still in horrible shape, mm-hmm. when it's not.
Right.
You know, we're in great shape, and that's credit to Jerry Brown. Mm-hmm. But the issue of homelessness is an economic issue, not just in terms of those individuals, but I was having lunch just up the street on K Street, a popular lunch area for Capital folks, mm-hmm. today, and I was talking to a small businessman. He's open from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m.
You got someone camped out on your porch. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he said he wants to stay open longer. Yeah. But the homelessness and addict and mental health issues, not just homelessness, you know, we were talking about, there was an addict right in front that was cursing up a storm,
right.
because he couldn't get his NyQuil bottle open, and that's his drug of choice.
Right.
You know, this is a block from the Capitol.
Right.
And so now the mayor of Sacramento is going to chair this effort by Governor Newsom on mental health and homelessness. And hopefully there really is this partnership between the administration and legislature.
Yeah, I hope so, because it is important. You see it in every city. You know, before it was maybe more isolated to big cities, the downtown. Now it's really everywhere. It's a moral issue. It's a humanitarian issue, and something needs to be done. And I like what he said. I think I like having Daryl Steinberg on that, because I know of his passion on that issue. So I'm optimistic that some things. But you know, the problem with homelessness, and we could devote, and you know, I don't want to
come back and just do homelessness.
Yeah. And I'd love to tell you about the program actually that I created in San Diego, which was hugely successful with the most severely mentally ill in San Diego County. We were really successful with that, called Project 25. But it's
the
so complicated.
Top users.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we took the 25 most expensive, the 25 most severely mentally ill, got them in housing and services. They're all still there. We actually ended up getting 38 in, but I'd already printed the brochures, so I kept it called Project. But we did a lot of great work on that, but it's complicated, because not only are they homeless, but they're mentally ill. They may be self-medicating with drugs and alcohol. Go down the list of all the problems that come into that you need to address. It's not just, well, I'll write a check and hopefully this works.
And they have legal rights.
It's
a balancing act.
And again, obviously they're well-intentioned, but the person you're talking about, standing on the street corner, to me, it's inhumane that he's out there. So even to bring him in and to get him services and let him make decisions in a more rational way is much more humane.
You know, I remember having this argument over like Thanksgiving dinner. And it's like, you know, a lot of these narratives are really binary, and they ought not to be. It's like, you know, why do we bring people in from the cold? Because they're cold. Well, yeah, you know, you can kind of make this argument about housing homeless folks from a, you know, bleeding heart liberal perspective, mm-hmm. but you can also say, you know what? If we put them in a modest apartment, we prevent just one emergency room visit, that little apartment paid for itself.
I'll give you a great example. Yeah. One of the people I housed with my project that I created was called 911 every single day. 365 days a year. After he got in my program, he called them zero times. So you think about the savings, you think about what that means for response time, right? Because the ambulance has got to come out there every single day, which means they're 2 minutes slower responding to an actual emergency, not this guy's mental illness. The cost savings that we had in 1 year, we saved taxpayers over $5 million in 1 year, and we solved a problem.
Yeah. Very cool. Hey, last question for you, Scott, unless you have anything else. What's after the assembly for you? I mean, you go back to law? What do you think?
I don't know. I never imagined, when I left the city council, I never imagened I'd work with the homeless. And then when I was there, I never really imagined I'd run for the assembly. So I'm just, you know, I'll see what happens, and who knows.
Okay, very cool.
I think that's a great wrap. It's been a wonderful conversation.
And Thank you, guys.
We talked politics, we talked San Diego, we talked current policy, what's ahead this year. We talked the state of the state. I think this is a great launch for the new partnership between Sactown Talks and The Nooner, and a great introduction for me personally. You've been here for 6 years. I ended up my community college advocacy life during that time. I started my writing from home life during that time. So we didn't get a real chance to meet until today, and it's been a great pleasure.
I feel the same.
Thank you
the same,
both.
Guys.
There we go. Well, that's a wrap.